Joel, are you ready? Okay, now. We'll open committee, Senate Committee on Healthcare, Human Services, and Rural Health Policy Subcommittee. No, excuse me. Subcommittee on Healthcare Reform.
There is
agenda in front of me here. To my understanding, Senate Bill 91 is ready to go. And if I see any nods to the contrary, we'll deal with it differently. So I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 91.
Members of the committee, Senate Bill 91 requires health insurance carriers to offer health benefit plans that provide bronze and silver level plan coverage. And you do have a dash one amendment.
Is there anyone to testify?
Rocky's here.
You want to tackle this, Rocky?
We did tackle this. This is, we did hear this last week.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rocky King. I'm the interim director for health programs for the Oregon Health Authority. And, Mr. Chair, what did you want me to do here? We've gone, do you want a quick recap of
If it's ready to go, then let's go.
It's ready to go.
It's ready to go. Are there any questions or comments? Okay, we've worked it to death. Senator Bates?
Mr. Chair, I would recommend the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 91.
Actually, you need to move.
I move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 91.
It's been moved the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 91, dated 3/22/11. Discussion. Hearing none. Objections? So ordered. The bill.
Mr. Chair, question first. Are we going to get a physical on this? I don't think there's a physical on it, is there, Brian?
We don't have to get a physical to pass it out of the subcommittee, but we will when it goes to the full committee. But to pass it from the...
Oh, that's a rare subcommittee. Thank you. Remind me. I forgot. Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 91 with the dash one amendments to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
It's been moved Senate Bill 91 with dash one amendments to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered.
Make him take that stuff back.
Close the work session on Senate Bill 91 and open a work session on Senate Bill 99. Rocky, Lori. Now tackling the dash threes.
Sarah Morris, members of the committee. My name is Lori Freeman. I'm with the Office of Legislative Counsel, and I'm here to go over the changes to Senate Bill 99 made by the dash three amendments. Did you all receive the memo that I drafted that summarized the significant changes? So it doesn't matter because I'm going to go over them.
We did.
Okay. The first one appears on page 1, lines 7 to 8. And we had defined essential health benefits tracking the federal law's definition of essential health benefits, which the feds are still figuring out what that means. But there is a provision in the federal law that is likely to be moved up to an earlier date, but currently begins 2017, that allows states to get waivers. And so this authorizes the state to have an alternative essential benefit package if we can get a waiver. Next one is on page 6.
No, I think change that from requirements to standards.
Yeah, but I'm talking about significant changes.
Okay.
Is Rocky trying to slide one through?
Yeah. Well, we changed standards, guidelines to standards throughout, but
right.
Okay. Page 6, line 14. This is the grounds for the governor to remove any member of the board, Health Insurance Exchange Corporation board. And before it just said for cause, and this says, and it's picked up from similar language in other statutes, for incompetence, neglect of duty, or malfeasance in office. And page 7, lines 6 through 26, we had, in an earlier iteration, we had had this more detailed restriction on who can serve on the board. In the dash 2, we changed that to you can't have a conflict of interest, and now we're going back to the more prescriptive limitations on who may serve. On page 8.
Let's field the questions as we go.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lori, so as I'm looking at the board makeup, it does prescribe that 2 out of the 7 of the voting members, about 30%, need to be people in the individual or small group markets. But the rest of them, the governor can appoint whoever they want to these positions. They don't have to be any of the people prescribed on page 7. Is that correct?
Well, the subsection 4, which begins on page 6, has some qualifications for board members. But maybe I'm not understanding your question. There's nothing that requires more than these consumer members, as long as they can meet the requirements of on page 7, lines 1 through 5, for collectively offering expertise, knowledge, and experience in insurance and so forth,
mm-hmm.
including the use of the health insurance exchange is one of the qualifications you see on page lines 4 to 5, and that was intended to pick up consumers and payers.
Mm-hmm. So can I ask a follow-up?
Yes.
I mean, it seems to me that the purpose of this section is to be fairly general, right? That the makeup of the entire board needs to have these kinds of skills and qualifications generally provided. But so there would be nothing that would prohibit the governor from appointing every single person being either in the small group or individual markets as long as they had generally these particular sets of skills.
Sarah Morrison, Senator Shields, I guess that's true, as long as they can bring the expertise to the board that's required by the statute or by the bill.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, for the record, I'm Rocky King, Interim Health Programs Director for the Oregon Health Authority. Senator Shields, I think, to get to your question, I think there are 9 voting members. 2 of those are the OHA or the designee, and the DCBS or designee, I believe.
Oh, I didn't realize they were voting members.
They are voting members. And the other Senator Shields I'm going to point out is lines 26 through 30, and then the following paragraph on page 6.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of gives the, I believe, the, some of the individual requirements of the board members. So lines 26 through 30 on page 6 and 1 through 5 on page 7.
Okay. But,
does not preclude then what you, I think, your statement, which is the remaining members could come as long as they met those requirements.
Mm-hmm. And follow up, Mr. Chair. So again, my sense is that 1 through 5 are kind of general, that if the governor looks at the nine members of the board, he's not going to have to say, he or she is not going to have to say, well, I don't have anybody with Health Benefits Administration, so I must appoint someone. This is the governor will have a fair amount of discretion as long as kind of good business sense is being used. Okay. Thank you.
I would concur.
Mr. Chair, and also a Senate confirmation on those two. So if it got too out of balance, I doubt if it would, there is a check and balance in the system.
Mr. Chair, can we discuss this just for a few moments? Are you planning to bring testimony up on these issues, or is this going to be just a discussion amongst the committee with invited testimony?
What I'd like to do is go through this and then...
And come back to it.
And then, well, for members of the committee... Here, let's discuss it as we go through it, and then for those that are here and want to testify, then we'll open that up.
Okay. This is, from my point of view, just so you make it clear, there's two sticking points in this bill yet. There's lots of technical stuff that I think Lori's taking care of, but there's two sticking points. One's brokerage, and the other one's this. And I just want to point out for the starting of the discussion, this limits the number of people from the industry that can be in this. It doesn't say they have to be there. You can have no one there from the industry under this bill. You are required to have two ex officio members, one from DCBS, one from the health authority, and you have two others that are consumers or consumer or someone who pays for it, so to speak, small business. So four out of the seven right now are sitting that way. The other three are still open. And it's not prescriptive. It does not say they must be from the industry. And I think that's an important point when we have to keep in our minds as we go through the discussion. And it limits the other five positions they can't be. So, I mean, it says no more than two, but you don't even have to have that two if you don't want to. Then what the Senate and the governor decide as far as who they suggest and confirmation. That leads to questions of who's the governor, who's in the Senate, who's in control. Those issues start popping up, too. But we've discussed this now for almost 9 months, probably. We're back to the original language, basically. So, and it's something like many bills we see in this building, nobody likes it now, which means we're probably pretty close. Okay, so I'll stop there.
In fact, this language going back is not my preferred language. And this is very open. You're very right, Senator Shield. It's very open. The entire membership could be consumer members, providing they meet the general requirements, which are quite general. So I think there's a tremendous flexibility in the composition, in the selection of the composition.
Not that any of the groups that are concerned might not lobby a governor or a Senate about it. I mean, I don't think that would ever occur, right? I mean, this is a wild guess on my part.
Okay. Anything else? Lori?
Okay, moving on to page 8. This was Representative Kinnemer's suggestion last time, and that was lines 4 and 6. We just reversed the first. So that you have two serving for the shorter term and three serving for the longer term. And then on line 22, we're allowing the governor to appoint an interim executive director. Before it was 90 days, and now it's 120 days. And lines 28 through 30 were intended to address Senator Cruz's concerns about having what happens if you have co-speakers or co-presidents.
That never happened.
Page 9.
Good.
Something.
I'm sorry. I got a little confused on page 7 again. It says no more than two of the members who are not ex officio members, maybe individuals who are, and then you got small A, big A, B, C, and then B. Is there two sets there, or is basically lines 8 through 20 all one set? Because we have an of in there, and I mean, could it be two from one group and potentially and then two from the other group, or is it all just one group that we can only have two of?
From either the people described in, excuse me, Sarah Moore, Senator Cruz, either the people that are described in paragraph A, which begins on line 8,
mm-hmm.
or paragraph B, which begins on line 13, that as a whole group, you can't have more than two members.
Okay, so it's not two and two, it's just two inclusive. Okay, thank you.
Okay. On page 9, we added these subsections that require additional reporting back to the Legislative Assemblies. Subsection 6 specifies what has to be reported with respect to the IT system, and it's based on the LFO's report of what the agency is going to have to report back on their information technology system. And then subsection 7 says the same information then also has to be reported to interim committees and Joint Committee on Ways and Means prior to the 2012 session. And then in 8, and which goes over to page 10, we have the requirements for reporting on a formal business plan. And this is set up that if they have the formal business plan prior to the beginning of the session, that's fine, they can report on it, but it allows for the possibility that they might not have one. But in any event, they have to have a formal business plan, and they have to report it to the Legislative Assembly no later than February 1st, 2012. And then you'll see later on in Section 27, we make the implementation of the exchange contingent on approval of the formal business plan by the Legislative Assembly. On page 10 again, subsection 4, this just, there had been some concerns about the definition of conflict of interest, just picking up the Chapter 244 definition. And for one, it was because a member of a board of directors of a tax-exempt organization is exempt, and there were concerns that a tax-exempt health system hospital board member would be able to serve. And the other was the concern about, well, wouldn't anyone who consumes health services or pays for health services have a conflict of interest? So I took the definition that was in 244, and I just modified it to try to address those two concerns. So that's why it's picking up a lot of the defined terms from 244, but it doesn't actually pick up the definition of conflict of interest from 244. I'll give you a second. Look at that one.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
One of the issues about having somebody from the industry be a physician or insurance executive or anybody else on this board was this conflict of interest, not only from the point of view of being able to vote, which they can't, but also they could sway the other board members through a discussion because they had greater knowledge. And Lori gave me a great example of an attorney being allowed on a jury. And she indicated to me that, generally speaking, if a attorney is in a pool of jurors, they usually get excluded because nobody wants them in there. Well, that's another thing about not wanting attorneys around, but that's a different story. But on this particular issue, it's because they can sway juries if they're discussing because of their greater knowledge. And this language clearly says they can not only not vote, but they can't participate in any discussion of when they have a conflict. I don't know how much clearer you can make something in something. I mean, that's what it says, 20 and 21, page 10, right?
That's correct.
You know, if there's a clear conflict of interest, you can't talk about it to the board members, and you can't vote. Am I reading that right?
That's correct.
That's correct, Senator.
You're clear. I mean, some people probably don't like that, and some people are going to love it. So I just want to make that sure that's clear to everybody. It's line 20 and 21, page 10, correct?
That's correct, Senator.
Okay, Mr. Chair, just to make sure, we are talking about a real conflict, not an assumed conflict, correct?
Well, there, Senator Moore, Senator Cruz, there's actually very little difference between the definition of an actual conflict of interest and a potential conflict of interest. It's kind of a confusing thing in our chapter. So what I did here instead was not talk about actual or potential, but just say conflict of interest. And then I picked up the meat of the definition, which you find in both actual and the definitions of both actual and potential conflict of interest.
Okay, if I could follow up. The way it's written here, you're talking about a self-declared. What about a challenge from another board member?
Senator Moore, Senator Cruz, that isn't addressed in this.
Okay, I mean, that's where I get into to the assumed. And, I mean, you're right, there's a fine line, but but I'm assuming that Doc Bates has got a conflict. He doesn't think I was, so I'm going to challenge him on his conflict that I think he's got a conflict. So does that silence him when he really doesn't think he has one? I mean,
Senator Moore, Senator Cruz, I can't answer that. I can try to figure that out for you. It might be something just within the conflict of interest chapter that might address that issue, but I'm not as fluent in that area.
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, if I may, sitting on a number of boards, there are times when a board member will have to go to the administrator or the staff person, and they'll have to get legal counsel's opinion on whether it is a conflict of interest or not. And I've run into that myself, being on the PEB board, and my role as the administrator, for example, for OMIP and FEOP. There were times when I had to put on the table, is this a conflict of interest or not? And it could be from a perception standpoint, yes, and it could be from a legal standpoint, no. So when those occur, I think that generally boards put it on the table and you have some discussion about it. And sometimes you have to ask for an opinion.
Senator Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm pleased that on line 29 it says, or any business with which the member or the member's relative is associated. So, again, just to get on the record, your point of view on this is that, so that I'm not offending any of our good friends in the audience, let's say somebody, a vice president from Humana is appointed to this, to the board, and would that be considered a conflict with their associated business, and that they could not vote or discuss anything that was related to their employer?
Senator Moore, Senator Shields, this says when on any issue that's before the board, if there's a conflict of interest that meets this definition, they can either be part of the discussion nor vote on the issue.
They cannot.
They cannot.
Right. Thank you.
Okay, now we're zipping over to page 15, lines 19 through 20. And this was in the Dash 2 amendments, we had changed this to ensure that anyone who's licensed licensed in the state may offer a qualified health plan through the exchange. And we added an additional condition that meets the applicable federal requirements for participating in the exchange, because there are some additional federal requirements that an insurer must meet in order to participate in the exchange. And page 16, line 30, this was my boo-boo. I forgot no, so we put no back in there. So it says employers with no more than 100 employees rather than employers with more than 100 employees.
Nice try.
Okay, then beginning on page 18, line 28, and going over to page 19, I just took the language that was in the previous amendment, but I tabulated it to try to address Representative Greenlick's concern about the interpretation of the way it was written. And I see he's not here, but hopefully that addressed his concern.
Line 28, 18 through what line on?
Through
19.
Line 16.
So you just made bullets out of a paragraph.
Yeah.
Okay, whoops. Now on page 23, line 8.
Yes.
Every time I look at this, I think of something else, and I probably should stop. Yeah, I should probably stop looking. line 9.
What page?
Page 19. Back to 19, line 9. And I don't know what federal law is requiring as the status person as a United States citizen or lawfully admitted non-citizen, any resident of this state. I'm assuming that Medicaid doesn't run into a problem with that, and Medicare potentially could, but Medicaid doesn't. By that I mean, when you come into this state from another state, as an example, and you apply for Medicaid, if you're in the right category, you are automatically granted Medicaid. You don't have to be a resident state to do that.
Right.
I'm wondering, since Medicaid's going to be in the exchange, if we're going to have a push-shove here. Think that through. Not right this minute, later, okay? But you maybe have a situation where if OHP's inside the exchange and someone comes in to get in, do they have to be a resident state to get a Medicaid? I thought that became eligible immediately because it's a federal matched program.
Senator Bates, they would have to establish that they're a resident of the state in order to receive Medicaid benefits in this state. But presumably, if they had just closed a case from a previous state, there would be a fairly seamless conversion. Now, that wouldn't be true probably if you have someone who receives SSI benefits in another state and moves in this state. Well, no, I take that back. You'd still have to establish that you're a resident of the state in order to get benefits through this state because it's a joint federal and state program. So our state monies are going into our state share.
And my memory may be wrong, Mr. Chair, on this, but my memory is that when you come in from out of state and if you qualify for Medicaid, you have to declare your intent to become a resident of the state, and you're in Medicaid at that point. You're not actually a resident, just declaring your intent to be a resident. And we've had problems with that from people on the borders coming in, getting a service, leaving immediately afterwards, and we end up paying for it. You know, Walla Walla resident wants a gallbladder out, and you know, they don't qualify in Washington because the qualification is slightly different. They come over, get something, then leave. We've had some rare instances of that, but it does occur. Let me go back and look at that again. Okay? I don't know if anybody's here from DMAP to tell us for sure, but I think there's a little trick in there we got to look at. I'll go back. I'll come back to you on it, okay? And I'll stop looking.
Okay, let's see. We had moved up to page 23, line 8, we just added this little parenthetical to make clear that the charge, which we used to call an assessment on the insurers for the operations of the exchange, it's based on the number of enrollees in their plans, but it does not include Medicaid recipients or PEB or OEB people who might get benefits through the exchange. And that's just in the calculation of their assessment.
Lori, if we could go back to page 20, section 15. I think, and we had discussed prior to our meeting that there's maybe some things we need to address with respect to when you have a legitimate cause of action. And you have language that essentially precludes disclosure or discovery. And that's something I think we need to address to bring back some language for the, for that.
Yes, Senator Morse, I did see some comments that someone had submitted, and I think it was probably my bad. We should have had documents, materials, or confidential documents, materials, or other information on line 16, because the rest of the section all refers to confidential documents, and I think that was the intent of the section, was just to say if it's confidential, you got to keep it confidential. So I think we just need to add a word there. Hopefully that'll do that. Okay, on page 23, and
just
oh, go
on
ahead,
that,
sorry.
Mr. Chair, yes, do you have the same problem on page 21, line 17? Again, we're referring to documents. Does that still have to be? Do you still have to list it confidential, or is that just assumed? I mean, you listed. That is otherwise
confidential.
Well, yeah, you have to kind of go down a ways, but lines
you're right.
18 didn't.
Yeah, I see it. And the same with line 27.
Senator Moss Anderson, yes, because it's under this section.
Thank you.
Okay, and then on page 3, or 23, I'm sorry.
Let's not go back.
Subsection 3, we had a line in there before that we should have taken out, that we took out of this one, that says, for purposes of this subsection, future net losses includes reserves for claims incurred but not reported. And that should have gone away through an earlier iteration, and it didn't.
That's kind of insurance language.
I had some insurers think that was a pretty good idea.
All right, and then on page 26, lines 18 through 20, we added subsection 2, which requires people who are employees of the exchange, applying for employment with the exchange, or who either are employees or are contractors of the exchange who have access to information technology, payroll functions, mailroom duties, and other sorts of sensitive, access to sensitive information, that the corporation shall conduct a state and a nationwide criminal records check on those individuals. And then on page 30 is the new section 27, which conditions the operation of the exchange, not the corporation, but the getting the exchange up and running, is contingent on Legislative Assembly approval of the formal business plan.
And this would require an affirmative action on the part of the legislature.
Senator Morse, that's correct.
So it would be in the form of a bill.
That's correct.
Yes. Just so people understand that what's expected in the process.
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Chair. Or going back to the background check, so we're requiring both a LEDS and an FBI? Because usually it's one or the other, but...
Senator Moore, Senator Cruz, it is both.
Okay. That's a higher bar than we usually set, but...
Senator Moore, Senator Cruz, I think sometimes it's optional. You can do one or the other or both, and perhaps Mr. King could address that better.
Ms. Chair, Senator Cruz,
you mean
no,
the criminal aspect?
Okay.
Ms. Chair, part of the reason for the question is we're trying to consolidate a lot of background check functions in agencies so that And we're doing it for medical students, mm-hmm. that one bill. Mm-hmm. And, of course, that's just a lead's check at that point, I believe, isn't mm-hmm. it? So at some point in time, we're trying to get some uniformity and some consistency and background checks. So, like, once you've been through it in one place in the system, you don't have to go through it again if you're going to, that sort of thing. So mm-hmm. that's the reason for the question.
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, originally I believe this was your language. We have an opportunity. Would you like us to change that and or?
I think the flexibility might be good.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm.
You're talking about line 18.
Line 18.
And be up the executive director to make that decision.
Depending on what the job is.
Yeah. And we've had a little trouble in DHS lately that we're just a little nervous right now.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair?
Okay. Yes.
Lori?
Page 30.
Page 30, line 20.
You're starting over again?
Through 23. Could you tell me in plain English what that says? It's sort of the party of the first part, the party of the second part, says the party of the first part, that's the party of the second part, which is the party of the third part, is I'm lost. What is it really saying? And this is about the 50 and 100 employees, 50 employees, 100 employees. What are these two things?
Wait, what page are you on?
Page 30. It says the members of Section 11 of this Act by Section 12 of the Act become operable at a later date. Later of the date, the legislative assembly approves the formal business plan submitted by the corporation. I think it just says that this is the part of the trigger. You can't go forward until we get it, right?
Yes, Senator Morris. Senator Bates, you'll recall in the previous version we had the smaller groups would roll in immediately, and then in 2016 you had the larger small groups. So this just says, we can't have the 2016 date because there might not be legislative approval before that time. So this just takes that into account.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we could turn to page 15, Lori. Can you let me know if I'm reading Section 11, Subsection 3 correctly, that any insurer with a certificate of authority, et cetera, may offer a qualified health plan through the exchange? My concern with this, and I'd like perhaps some discussion on the committee, is that I think a health plan on paper could meet the requirements, right? You can check off the list. But then kind of the totality of the evidence, maybe they've had 150 complaints about, not paying providers promptly, or their contracting practices are such that the board might think that, perhaps they shouldn't be operating. And I think my concern is that if you look at the totality of the evidence, that this section could restrain the ability of the exchange board to make some simple decisions about who should be in and who shouldn't. I understand that the next section kind of addresses that, but maybe we could just have some discussion about that topic. Do you think that does limit the Iraqi, perhaps, if you'd like to answer, since Lori doesn't have a point of view on anything, whether or not that, in your view, limits the board's decision-making on who's in and who's out?
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, it may limit whether a qualified plan is in or out. The standards I think we set for an insurer to come in are two, basically, certificate of authority to do business in the state to meet other federal requirements. And by the way, one of the technical pieces that has been suggested to us is to say only an insurer with a certificate as opposed to any. We'll be bringing that to you, I think, later this week. But through those uniform requirements and standards and criteria for the certification of a plan may include such things, it seems to me, as network adequacy. It may include appearance to state the requirements around prompt payment or what other standards and criteria that that board may establish relative to that plan. So the way you get at that is not with the insurer. It seems to me it's by the standards that you establish against that plan. So we don't say, for example, that a carrier has to have statewide network adequacy. If they are in one area, we're saying if you're going to offer the plan in this area, then you have certain standards for that area that you need to meet. One of those may be some of those that you talk about. But they're going to have to be very explicit. They're going to have to be, you know, something that people can look at and agree on. I don't think they can be judgmental criteria, meaning that the board can sit back and say, well, I don't like the way their customer service people answer the phone. I don't think that's going to be the kind of criteria that we look at. But if there are customer satisfaction data that we collect on these carriers and that you have to meet certain standards relative to that customer satisfaction, then it's objective, and I think you can use that relative to offering the qualified plan, but not from offering or to proposing that your plan be considered. I don't know if that makes sense. Probably, I'm sure it doesn't get to some of the comments because I've had an opportunity to read a number of the comments that you've made. Probably get to maybe where you want to get, but I think it's more than just you're in, you're in.
Follow up if I can. Well, I mean, a lot of the things that you just mentioned, I don't think anybody tracks in the insurance division or in the health authority that I know of. How do we gauge customer service and all of the various plans in the state now?
Ms. Chair, Senator Shields, no, we don't. But I think we will begin, as people get involved with the exchange, I think, to look at what kind of standards we want to establish for participation in the exchange.
And just a follow-up comment. I guess my concern is that at some point somebody's got to be a decision-maker on that. And I would just be very concerned if, WellPoint came and said, no, you have to let us have a plan in the exchange because that's what this law says.
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, I don't think that's what the law says. I think what the law says, if you have a certificate of authority, you meet the federal requirements, you have the opportunity to put forth a qualified plan. If that qualified plan then meets whatever requirements or standards that are established by the exchange, then yes, we would be obligated, because we want to treat all the plans equally, if they met those standards, to be able to offer that. That's a little different nuance, I think, from the way you probably expressed it.
Sure. Could I one last follow-up, and then we'll move on. So let's say the board says, okay, we've got these five or six standards that, the insurance company has to do a prompt pay, and they somehow we figure out ways where we can actually gauge that in a, quantitative rather than a qualitative way. Then they make a decision and say, I'm sorry, based on the way that you do business, you're not going to be able to put it in a plan. They could make that decision, and then I assume that the insurance company could then contest that decision, just like any other decision by a state agency, going back to page 4 through chapter 183 in the Administrative Procedures Act. Is that what the thought would be?
Ms. Chair, Senator Shields, I believe that is correct. And I think it's important to note that there will be a contract between the exchange and the carrier for those whatever performance standards are laid out relative to those qualified plans and participation in that exchange.
And finally, last word. I just want to get on the record that there is some decision-making authority here for the exchanges, the exchange board to say yes or no on who's accepted and who isn't.
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, to the qualified plans that are accepted, you are correct.
Thank you.
Maybe, Rocky, if you would address what service the exchange would provide to consumers in terms of ranking, rating, metrics of the various plans.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, there are a number of requirements in the federal law that relate to information that the exchange has to provide around customer service, I believe, around network adequacy. I think there are a variety of things. Being able to get onto the exchange and lay out what your income is and been able to see what different things are going to cost you. Different plans will have different out-of-pocket costs. What does that mean in terms of real money and as it relates to your income? We have to do a calculation to see if you are, for example, through the eligibility process, subject to the individual requirement or whether you're exempt from that. If the coverage is beyond, 8% of your income, I believe it is. There are all kinds of standards in or information pieces that we'll be able to put in there. We saw a demonstration of a portion of that with eHealth, that people will be able to ask those kinds of questions. What hospitals are you contracted with? In your Portland area, for example, a lot of people assume that an insurer has a contract with every hospital. Well, they don't. There are certain hospitals that are tied to certain carriers, and you'll be able to ask those kinds of questions. In addition, to look at price and benefits across some standard plans, for example, the bronze and the silver, and in the exchange, they must also provide the gold plan. So you know you're going to have three plans and all the multiple choices provided by those carriers in those three levels, bronze, silver, and gold levels, and then to the degree that you have gold or platinum plans also.
I think maybe the issue that Senator Shields is driving at is customer satisfaction and what metrics would the exchange be required with respect to measuring that.
Mr. Chair, that isn't laid out in statute, and I would hope that we would bring together nine people, seven appointed and two folks that are much brighter than I can, that can come up with some very objective and good kinds of customer service measures that they can include.
There's nothing that precludes that.
No, Mr. Chair, there isn't.
And so a lot of that will be set in rule. And then, am I reading this bill correctly that all of the rules that we do in the health insurance exchange would have to be approved by the board?
Yeah, Ms. Chair, Senator Shields, yes. Again, to your comments that you made, I believe the rule authority is in this bill is to the exchange, which is approved by the board.
Senator Shields, the federal law actually requires exchanges to do customer satisfaction surveys.
And to rank them.
And we have on page 3, line 21, a requirement that the website and the toll-free hotline provide information about the quality and enrollee satisfaction ratings.
There it is.
And can I ask?
But again, it's
I hate to monopolize the conversation. Can I ask another question, Mr. Chair?
No, that's what we're here for.
All right. So the challenge, I think, is that a lot of customer satisfaction surveys are nuanced, and to say it requires qualitative in addition to quantitative data. You also, I think a lot of the things that that happen in the health insurance world, the customer might not ever see. So, for example, if an insurance company's contracting practices are such that they're out of compliance with Oregon law, or they reimburse very low for certain procedures, the customer might not ever see that, but the providers would. And I think my point is, I want to kind of establish a record here that customer satisfaction is very nuanced, and that the exchange board may have to make some decisions that, you know, it's not just is it above 85% or below 85%, that they're going to have to make some decisions that aren't quite that obvious. I mean, you know, for example, Regents and Providence, you know, reimburse quite well for primary care, and a lot of the other providers don't.
Senator Bates?
I'll probably follow on with Senator Shields a little bit. The bill, as it's presently written, does more. It really is a sea change as far as how an individual looks at this who's buying insurance or a small company buying the insurance or for the providers also. Things are embedded in here that are not present right now. For instance, if you want to buy health insurance for your employees at this point, you're a little vague in what that benefit really is. It's hard to figure that out. You may have a brochure to look at. You may have bits and pieces, but you don't really know. And when you compare it to the next policy, you have a hard time laying those benefits up. This clears that away, correct? Second thing it does, allows you to compare directly premium, co-pays, and deductibles, which could be important for your employees or not, depending what kind of a company you have. Right now, when you, from a point of view of a provider, you can't tell, look at an insurance policy, what that payment's going to look like. What's going to be denied at the last minute? What's pre-authorized, not pre-authorized? What explanation of benefits to the patient or the company is? It's a mess. This eliminates all those issues. Well, we can't sit down here and specify in this bill how to do it. It has to be in rules. But this calls that out and says you must do those things. Right now, if I look at five insurance companies, they're not rated 1 through 5, which one is the best for customer service, which are the best as far as the providers are concerned, which one has wellness programs that the patients really like. You can't tell that stuff. But this exchange will do that for us. So it's not just a matter of looking at the exchange from the point of view of a bunch of insurance choices you have. This is your benefit package. This is your co-pays and deductibles. There's much more embedded in this, and it's in the language here if you read carefully. Does it spell every single absolute word out? No, because you can't do that in this kind of a bill. That's what we have rules for. And so I think what most people are looking for, if they sit back and take a deep breath, it's probably here. But you got to look at it, and you got to have a little faith, too. You're going to have a board that's going to do things the right way, and you're going to have rules that will make sense for you. And Senator Shields, I think we're both on the same page in this thing. You're just putting on the record that this stuff should be done. Mm-hmm. This isn't just look at a couple of insurance companies now, and you get a tax credit for it. This is much more than that. And it really is a sea change for those of us in the business at both ends, like I am. It's a huge change. It's a little hard for me to even grasp some of the changes, because it's going to be so big if this actually occurs, as we hope it will. So there's a lot of people in the audience listening. Take a deep breath. Look carefully before you say yes or no. I think this bill does a lot more good than people realize. And it's got things built in to try to keep everybody comfortable in this. And this is a key part of it. This is Section 3 here. It doesn't say shall. It says may. That gives the board an opportunity to select those plans which meet all the criteria that they think are appropriate, that are embedded in this. Not just the criteria that met federal requirements, you know, or state requirements, but look at all those requirements where you put it together. You know, if they have a very poor track record, you know, in customer service, or poor track record as far as dealing with providers, they may not make it into the exchange. And the board has that power, correct?
Could you say that out loud? The Court of Appeals is listening.
Right. Mr. Chair, Senator Bates and Senator Shields, it's my understanding that if those standards are not met as they apply to the qualified plan, that the board will have the ability to say no.
Thank you. And a responsibility to say no.
Correct, Senator Bates.
Thank you.
Ultimately, the best no comes from the consumer. And if the consumer has information upon which to make a decision, that's ultimately your best solution. I mean, that's the market at work.
That's right.
As an example, I needed to buy a printer at home for my computer. Well, I went online, and I actually looked at the ratings for various products. And the product that I was going to buy, I decided not to buy, based on the many of the comments of that specific product. And it took me in an entirely different direction. I would see that same thing happening here based on the level of information that the consumer has to make the choice that's best for them in their area. Senator Shields.
Senator Cruz,
No. You're on a roll.
Well, I would, Mr. Chair, agree with your point. I would perhaps limit its scope a little bit, because in the individual market where it's not guaranteed issue, if you make a decision about your, quote, printer, you really can't make another one, because then if you are subject to having a pre-existing condition, it's not as if you can go from one carrier to one carrier. And that the exchange is not going to change that. So I think that's why I'm trying to get on the record. It's very important for the board to oversee the products, because people have what economists call inelastic demand. They'll have to pay often what is offered in the individual market, because they can't just hop from one plan to the other because of pre-existing condition. And that's why I think I wanted to get some things on the record about this, and perhaps I think
I think this is still a work in progress, hopefully for the full committee as well, but also to underline the importance of regulation in DCBS and the insurance division as well, to make sure that people in the individual market have somebody advocating for them.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, beginning January 1, 2014, the individual market will be guaranteed issue with no pre-existing condition periods allowed. So that issue, there's many other issues I know that you and I have talked about that will still be there, but that one will go away, very similar to what we have for children now, guaranteed issue with no pre-existing condition period, and with the bills. Senate Bill 514, I believe, will actually expand that and even do a better job than we're doing now. But
your point's well taken. Yeah. Still, it's not easy to shuffle from plan to plan, just because your provider might not be in the same plan.
That's right.
But your point's well taken.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, if I needed a printer, I'd call Bud down at IT. And
Would he be a navigator or a broker?
No. Whichever he'd be, he would give me a lot better advice than I would get on my own looking on the internet. So, which brings up a couple points. That was a segue. That was what that was. Looking at the draft of this, Mr. Chair, I think we, the committee members, on page 7. With the makeup of the exchange, I'm wondering if we'd be better off going back to what we had in the dash 2, just as a thought. And well, we're already making some amendments.
That
let's make all the right ones.
Shelby.
And also on page 10, the conflict of interest, I think it's too restrictive. And I'll use the Bud example right now. What we're doing, let's assume for starters that the people on this board have a reasonable level of intelligence, okay, which I would think means that they aren't going to be overly swayed by somebody, but we are. By saying that that somebody with a conflict, if it's declared and they can't enter into discussion, you may limit in some expertise that might be important there. If the conflict is declared, then people know the perspective they're coming from, but that discussion may have value in the ultimate decision. I would agree that they shouldn't vote, but to totally silence them, I think, is going a step too far.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Okay, yes.
Do you remember who brought that idea forward to eliminate discussion?
Ms. Chair, Senator Morris Anderson, I think as a general practice of most boards that if you have a direct or an actual conflict of interest, that usually you will reclude yourself from the discussion and participation in the decision. Now, if you, one of the key things, I think, and what page was that on the conflict of interest? If you look at the, it's page 11, I guess. If you read the top of, it starts on section C on page 10, but you kind of have to follow it all the way through lines 1, 2, and 3. And there are a number of things that you think are conflicts of interest, but on the other hand, if its benefit or detriment would affect to the same degree a class consisting of all consumers or payers for health care in the state, that kind of opens up the door for, I think, some additional discussion. Now, Lori probably can give me the legal interpretation of that, but...
Well, the key word is probably pecuniary benefit or detriment.
Right.
Senator Morris Anderson, the current definition and provisions in Chapter 244 say they condition the definition of a conflict of interest on someone being a member of a class that to whom the pecuniary benefit or detriment would apply to the same degree. And so this just picks up that language, but it limits it only to people who are in a class consisting of all consumers or all payers of health care. So, if we're all going to benefit because as payers or as consumers, then that's not going to be a conflict of interest. But if you're in the health insurance industry, it would be a conflict of interest.
You know, people have gone up on the floor of the Senate and declared potential conflict of interest because their uncle's cousin has an interest in this or that, the other thing, and that does meet the definition of relative, doesn't it? I mean, you know, how far broadly are we expanding this? You know, my conflict is one thing. My sister, who lives in Florida, well, she doesn't anymore, so there would be a conflict now. But when she did, that's blood relative. I mean, you know, I just think we're maybe capturing too much here.
But Mr. Chair,
yes.
I think I wouldn't worry about that at this point. Once there is a real conflict, that can be changed. I think we're nitpicking it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Mona Sanderson, one of the things I like to do whenever possible is to prevent having to come back and fix something that should have been fixed on the front end.
Okay.
Well, I personally am comfortable with the language as it defines conflict of interest, and that's pecuniary benefit or detriment. And that's pretty clear. At least it is to me. So I don't know how the rest.
I'm actually agreed. I mean, the purpose here, what we're trying to get to, is to bring some expertise in a very complex situation from people who have actually dealt with these things in an insurance situation. We're asking that potentially up to two people will be allowed to do from what I'll call the industry be there. It might be a physician and it might be, you know, someone from an insurance company as an example. We're asking, though, that because of the inherent conflict of interest to bring in expertise on board, that be declared and potentially not be allowed to be part of the discussion. The other way to do this would be to say you can't have anybody there, and I think and get it from a committee, which I don't think is as good. Another way to do it would be, say, if you were retired from one of those positions, then you could do this. And you wouldn't have any active involvement in one of those companies at that point or be an active physician. You can split this thing a dozen different ways, and you never quite get there. If you want that kind of expertise on this board, there's always going to be inherently a little bit of a conflict. And I think you have to have a little bit of faith. And here in Oregon, we got pretty honest people. No one's going to sit in this board and say, what can I do to manipulate this exchange in a way that my company makes a whole lot of money? I just don't believe that exists at this level. And, I just don't think they do it, especially with this kind of language here. Can we make it perfect? No, I don't think we can. But I think the language is pretty good. Others may violently disagree, and they may well do that. But from my point of view, this gets us the expertise. It spells out what a conflict is pretty carefully. There are those who won't like the fact that they have to excuse themselves from the discussion at certain times when maybe we do need their expertise. So there's no perfect way of doing this that I can think of. So I'm going to support the present language, and we'll see what it looks like when we get the full committee.
Back to Senator Cruz's suggestion on the board makeup. What's the pleasure of the
board?
The dash two
language.
At this time of night, I can't remember the dash two said exactly what they said. I've got four different ones in my head that we looked at. What did the dash two say again? Can you review that for me? Lori, do you remember?
Senator Moore, Senator Bates, the dash two, I believe he's referring to, we just had a blanket saying that anyone who had a conflict of interest could not serve on the board.
No, we're talking about the board makeup.
About the board makeup itself.
That's right.
Not the conflict of interest.
We said that anyone who had a conflict of interest could not serve on the board, could not be a board member. And the concern was that we picked up the definition in 244.020, which would allow the exception for a board member on of a tax-exempt organization.
And then I think what Senator Cruz was driving at was page 7, line 6 through 20. That was in the dash 1s. It was taken out, I believe, in dash 2s, and now it's back in the dash 3s. And my question to the committee is, what would be the preferred version? Did I state it very accurately?
Could you say one more time what Senator Cruz is talking about?
Page 7.
He's trying to figure it out. Yes.
Right. I don't want to go back.
And
that's too prescriptive.
I don't have the dash 2s in front of me. Could you tell me?
I have a second.
The dash. If you look at page 7, uh-huh. The dash 2s excluded lines 6 through 20. And it had the general requirements, and then it said at least 2 members shall be from consumers, one mm-hmm. small, one big, or individual.
How do you think that's too prescriptive?
Still not getting the issue here. If I don't have dash 2s. Yes, I suppose.
We changed that language.
Who wanted it more prescriptive?
The 3s are more prescriptive than the 2s.
Ms. Chair, Senator Moss Anderson, I believe you folks did when we met with you last
week. I think it came.
This goes back to the dash 1s.
Yeah, this is the dash 1 language,
right.
As it is in the dash 3s. Is that right, Laurie?
That's correct,
yes.
Senator Moore.
One, two,
except that we
one.
Added a reference to a third-party administrator.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, because when I read the 2s, it's less prescriptive
it is.
Than
you're
the
right.
1s were.
Senator Moore,
and
Senator
I think
Cruz,
that gives more flexibility,
yeah.
is what I
correct.
Was thinking.
Yeah. I actually, my staff, Jeff, was kind of bringing down my... an edited copy of the dash 2s, which says go back to the dash 1s for the dash 3s. Okay, so that's what we did. We did it. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's been...
Well, what do you think?
Well, who knows what will happen to it when it's in the house. So.
Well, we're going to have a 4 here because there's some technical things. Do we want to go back to the 2s? I think it's... It's more flexible, I think it's probably better. But I'm not on this subcommittee.
Mr. Chair, yes. I believe that there were some proposed amendments, and that is why we made this the way it is, to make certain people and stakeholders more comfortable with the bill.
Can I make sure I understand the issue before I describe? Weigh in, although that often doesn't stop me.
Do you have a conflict of interest?
So basically the dash 3 say you can't have too many people that meet these requirements. And the dash 2s would say you can have as many of these people as you want as long as you've got the 2. So I appreciate Senator Cruz's concern. I don't think I'd feel comfortable going back to the dash 2 language.
Well, that's a good reason to do it, then.
Senator Shields, we have a discussion.
Yeah, that's
okay.
What I'm inviting.
All right, yes.
Some
your chair, I don't want to get people. I'm thinking back to 2 different times I've seen these kind of boards put together. One was a board in which there were 2 or 3 members, active members of an insurance company on it, and they really tried to run the show. It was really kind of difficult, and they were there were five or six or seven on that one, and two or three of them were insurers, and it didn't go well. Okay. Yeah, I also think of the health policy board we presently have for the chair of the board. If I remember right, the chair of the board, I think, is from Standard Insurance, retired. Am I correct here?
Correct.
That's gone very well. That was a retired member. Now, he's only one out of nine. But that's gone very well. He's brought his expertise to this with no apparent difficulty of swaying boards in any particular direction. So what I'm getting to here the long way around, would you feel significantly more comfortable if we only had retired people from the industry? Would that make any difference to you? Senator Mons Anderson indicates to me, no.
I think I'm advocating for keeping the Dash 3
okay.
as is. This would still allow somebody in that position to be one of the two people, right?
I'm on the Dash 3s myself. I accept them as the best compromise. I just wanted to try flesh out how you feel, where your thinking is.
Yeah, I mean, my point of view is that that having some limitations of people in the industry is probably a good thing.
Remember,
in the previous discussion, I talked about having more people in the small group markets and in the individual markets that they could just as easily run the board as others. So I think I'd feel more comfortable with the Dash 3s as they are.
You know, we're talking about this as being some self-selected board, and it's not.
No, I agree.
It's selected by the governor, for God's sakes.
And confirmed by the Senate.
What I'm looking at is giving the governor a little more flexibility to, in his wisdom, pick the people he wants to serve on this board.
You're preaching the choir here. I'm okay with the Dash 3 just the way they are. Okay,
let's do a survey. 3s?
Yep.
Yes.
3s?
Yes.
3s? The 3s have it. So.
With a little change.
So we'll stay with the Dash 3 basic languages. Okay. One other suggestion, looking at ORS 744. Brokers and agents are referred to as producers, and it might be wise to go back and change the language from agents and brokers to producers.
Now, didn't we have it the other way before? No, it's always been...
Senator Morris.
Ryan, look at that...
Oregon, I believe, has changed it to the word producers. Federal law uses agents and brokers, but state law generally refers to the agents as producers.
Hmm. Laurie, is there a problem with the language conforming with, even though it doesn't conform to state law?
Senator Morris, I think... And maybe Rocky knows, insurance producer is defined for purposes of the insurance code, and this bill doesn't add any of this to the insurance code. So, but we could, if it's a defined term, we could pick it up and say insurance producers as defined in.
Your call. That's a
we'll look at
technical
it.
Yeah. issue. But I just wanted to raise it.
Mr. Chair, we'll look at that issue and see if that would cause any problems or not. Get back to you.
Okay. Lori, did you have anything else?
No, Senator, I have nothing more.
I have one more issue.
Okay, Senator Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have one more issue. There's been a discussion about quotation marks cherry picking by insurers coming into the exchange. And back to the same language we've seen before, page 15, 18 to 21, it says may. And I'm going to make an assumption, I want you to make sure that assumption is correct, that the exchange has a responsibility to not allow cherry picking. that they will not allow plans to come in and just try to cherry pick the healthiest patients or write policies in a way that would that allow that to happen. I'm not sure how that would even occur since this is sort of a wide open competitive situation. I can't think of how they would go about doing that if they wanted to. But maybe since you've been in this business from that aspect and I haven't been, you can explain to me what that concern is that I've heard rather repetitively from two or three different sources that there's no language in here to prevent cherry picking in the exchange. I can't really figure out in my mind how that's going to happen in the first place, or if it is, what would change it.
And Ms. Chair, Senator Bates, let me talk a little bit about some of the adverse selection issues which relate to cherry picking, and but also just the behavior of folks to pick a plan, and if they're all the unhealthy people and they go to one plan, what does that do to the risk pool? So you have both carrier behavior, but you also have individual behavior that I think we need to be concerned about, but not just as it relates to the exchange, as a market as a whole. We have three federal risk mechanisms that will be on board January 1, 2014, two of which will be operated by the state, one by the feds. One is a reinsurance program very similar to how OMIP operates today, based on the conditions people have, and I'm assuming there will be a condition list. There will be a revenue sharing among carriers that is administered by the state to make sure that those that have all the diabetics or all the cancer people, that there's a shift of dollars that occurs there, very similar to what OMIP does now. Excuse me.
Is that federal or state?
That will be federally defined in cooperation with the state, but it will be state operated. The second is a risk adjustment program, and I can't tell you how all these, I'm sitting here under pressure, and I can't tell you all the details of these right now, but that I believe is also a state operated, federally defined in cooperation with the states and the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. And that one I believe is kind of it's not a risk corridor, but it's if certain I'm not going to try to explain it, because if I explain it's wrong, I'll get you some information on it. But the third one is operated by the federal government. It's called risk corridors. And so if your experience is above a certain level, you have to pay into a pool. So we'll say 103% of expected claims. If you're above that, you would have to pay into this pool. Then those people that are under 97% of expected claims, excuse me, if you're above 103, you would
the
take
way around.
Money.
Yeah.
If you're under 97%, you would pay in. It's a zero-sum game trying to make sure that you even up as best you can based on the populations that come in. Then the next thing so those are the three that we'll really know more about, I think, over the next 12 months. And I will tell you there are a whole bunch of actuaries that are sitting in some room designing this, trying to make sure that it's going to work and it's going to be good for the market as a whole, not just the exchange. Remember, you've got guaranteed issue coming in. You've got collapsing of the rate bands, a whole bunch of things that are going to incentivize people to do different things than they do today in terms of where they go and what they purchase. You also have the subsidies that are coming in. Then there's the other thing that we've done, though, which is Senate Bill 91, which is we've said every carrier has to provide a bronze plan and a silver plan, a defined bronze and a silver, across all markets in which they participate. So if they're outside the exchange, they've got to participate by providing the bronze and the silver plan. If they're inside the exchange, they got to do the same thing. And if they're in both markets, those plans got to both be there. In addition, in the exchange, you can't just come in and say, well, I'm going to do a bronze plan. You have to bronze, silver, and at least gold. Now, the exchange may say platinum also, but right now, between federal and state law, it's bronze, silver, and gold. So you have that kind of evening up a little bit. The other piece to that, which was Senate Bill 91, we said that the catastrophic plan can only be offered through the exchange. And that's one that we've had some concerns about, because you could come in as an outside carrier outside the exchange, new to Oregon and grab everybody under the age of 29 and absolutely put together a great healthy pool, a year later jump into the larger individual or small group market, we'll say individual market, and have great claims experience, be able to go underprice everybody that was here for 5 years or here for 10 years serving the rest of Oregonians, the older folks as well as the young folks. So by saying it has to be offered through the exchange, I think that gives us some protection. The final piece is what you talk about, which is I think that the board, as the federal government rolls out their programs and their requirements, I think a responsibility of the board is going to have to be to step back and say, is this enough? And if it's not, then I think they have to have the authority to begin to take action, at least within the exchange. If there are issues between the exchange and the outside market, I think it's very appropriate in 12 or 13, and probably 13, that we come back before you and say we have some concerns about the broader market, and perhaps we need that fourth mechanism for the entire market, not just for the exchange. But I will tell you that everyone is watching this. Everyone is concerned. The mechanisms, I believe, are in place to address it. The issue is, will the mechanisms work? And that's what we're going to have to monitor. I don't know if that helps.
Thank you. Thanks for getting the record.
And Senator Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then also, as part of the federal plan, they view insurance rate review as being a critical piece to make sure that the premium increases are not unreasonable. Is that correct?
I keep trying those tweaks.
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, the rate review is, I mean, there's a lot of federal scrutiny of rates. As you well know, there are many states that don't approve rates in either individual or small group market. Some of our neighboring states where they just are filed, and whatever they file, unless the political winds blow otherwise, they're able to charge that. Oregon, you know, I think we rank 35th in the country in terms of where our rates are. We have a pretty good rate review process. I'm not going to say it doesn't have holes in it, and I know there are a lot of bills to address some of those. But the exchange, one of the things I've asked and I'm hoping for is that the Department of Consumer and Business Services, in one of their next grant cycles for rate review, include an actuary that is going to actually coordinate and work with the exchange. It isn't just that the exchange is going to be out there on its own. I really think that it's going to be important that the exchange and the department be working very closely as we begin to look at benefit designs and the resulting rates that are put forth on those, so that we can ensure, first of all, the inside-outside market issues are addressed correctly. That is, they have to be the same price. But secondly, so that any kind of problems that come up relative to rates, that, again, there's cooperation between the exchange and the insurance division in looking at those.
I guess, Mr. Chair, if I could, what I was getting at is HHS is also saying that rate review is important. Yes?
Ms. Chair, Senator Shields, the state and HHS are extremely concerned about rates and the cost of health care in the state, all states.
Okay. Anything else for Rocky or Laura? Okay. Thank you very much. We will work on some more kind of small technical changes, and our goal will be to bring back a product to move out on Thursday evening. So we'll post for that.
When?
Thursday. This Thursday. To get it up to the full committee. So with that, if there's anyone that has any pressing issue they would like to bring before the committee, we would invite that testimony. If there's not, we will
looks like
all the day.
Looks, well, I think there's no.
Yeah, if you're ambivalent.
Good evening, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Tom Holt with Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield. Just very briefly, one, overall, we're very pleased with the progress being made on this bill over the last few weeks, and I think we're down to really, truly technical issues. And two, I just wanted to call out in Section 11, page 16, sub number 10 there from lines 15 to 19, there's been some interpretation, as our folks look at, and I think Elise will have some comments from AHIP, that That language may leave room for the exchange to be a selective contractor. And as we look at it, it's very clear that as a public corporation, the exchange must have the ability to contract, because unlike a state agency where you open the doors and say you do X, you're in, they actually have to have a contract with the carriers to offer a plan. But that language may need a little bit of tuning up to make clearer the intent. And then just the second point, in Section 15, the confidentiality language, we would suggest a very careful look at that, that I believe the intent is to protect, as it should, the warehouse full of information that will be, you know, personal health information that the exchange will have in its hands, but to be very clear that the exchange cannot just declare whatever it wants to be confidential and not accessible through a discovery process or freedom of information process, for example, but do protect the other information. I'm not quite sure whereas trying to draft on the fly and answer the question, I'm not quite sure that that change would quite get us to that point. And we did submit some language that I don't think was available in time for this version of amendments that our privacy officer came up with for us.
To a layman's,
and that's in your file.
To a layman's reading of this language, it's pretty bulletproof.
Yeah.
If you have a legitimate cause of action. You're denied due process.
Mr. Chair, that's exactly the issue that our legal experts see.
Yes.
Beyond that, I think, you know, we're very satisfied with the dash threes.
Okay. Elise?
Thank you, Chair Morris, members of the committee. Elise Brown on behalf of AHIP, America's Health Insurance Plans. And again, just briefly, wanted to make sure that for the record that we could clarify the issue that AHIP brought up to you Friday when we submitted comments March 25th to committee staff. And our issue remains the issue in Section 11 on selective contracting. If you look at Section 11, subsections 3 and 4 do the job of taking all qualified health plans, meet the requirements, get to participate in the exchange. But where we're reading further concern is in Section 11, sub 10A, that authorizes the exchange to enter into contract. So essentially, you meet the requirements, you get to participate in the exchange, but the way we read that, the exchange could say, we'll work with you, you or you, and we would suggest that that is selective contracting or at least limiting the participation by the carriers. We do have some suggestive language that we'd like to offer. I can do that now or work with committee staff.
Please do it as a follow-up.
Okay.
Only with Brian.
Pardon me?
Send it to Brian.
Okay. So that's our issue. We'd love to work with you. Again, just clarifying that it is not the intent of this committee to enter into selective contracting with that. Maybe verification of that would be appreciated.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'm not sure I quite understand what selective contracting means to you. I'll be clear what that means.
The way we're reading this, and I may get help from my...
No, just explain to what selective contracting is. Is that what this is? What's that mean?
Selective contracting, the way we understand this, means that the exchange would have the ability to select who they want to contract with. And the way we read the bill is any carrier that meets the basic qualifications as a certificate of insurance can participate in the exchange.
But we said earlier, we talked about the rulemaking that's going to happen that will, in fact, be selective. I mean, it'll be pretty straightforward, but it will be selective. Just because you meet the basic requirements, you still have to have other issues discussed. I think wasn't that what we were talking about earlier? That's why I'm asking the question. I want to make sure we're clear here.
That's why I wanted to ask Chair Bates as well, because the way we understand this is that Rocky had stated that there is not the intent to selective contract with carriers. All carriers that are eligible to participate can participate in the exchange. Is the way we understand it.
The phrase I saw was may participate.
The best language that I could put it in is based on my own experience. ODOT was our largest customer. You had pre-qualification standards. You had to meet those pre-qualification standards. And then when you had a project, there was scope of work that was defined, and you were eligible to bid on that contract. There was no selective contracting. you had that opportunity. If that's the intent of where we're going with this bill, I'm comfortable with it. If it's otherwise, to where brown eyes win and blue eyes don't, you know, kind of thing, then that is not the direction that I believe we should go. If, I see Rocky kind of nodding his head back there.
Mr. Chair, that's exactly the concern that some have looked at the language, that we expect that the exchange will set standards for participation, but we believe the intent should be that if you meet those standards, then you can play.
And I would agree.
And those standards can be in rule.
Exactly.
Mr. Chair, if I could, I think, you know, Tom and Elise's comments kind of elevate my concerns about the subsection 3 and how, you know, what the dance that Rocky and I were doing there was saying that, yes, there is going to be some decision-making authority for the Exchange Board. And then I think what we're hearing there is that the impression of the insurers is that there won't be much decision-making authority in the Exchange Board. Am I reading you right?
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, if I could clarify a little bit. I think we all agree that standards can include things like your track record. You know, if you have a long list of complaints with the insurance division, that would be a a consideration, I would think. So as we've talked about it, we've talked about being in good standing and those sorts of things. But generally, you meet the standard, then you can come in. But you know, the board doesn't get to say, well, today we like carrier A and we don't like carrier B that are otherwise meet our standards. You know, carrier A and carrier B need to be able to participate.
Yeah, clear and objective standards.
Yeah. Exactly.
But the decision of the board is going to be the standards they set.
I think maybe I'm getting there. Can I help? I'll help myself out here. Selective contracting could be very arbitrary. The phrase selective contracting to you means a very arbitrary decision by a board that's not based on any rulemaking or anything in the law. They just say, today, we don't like you. If for instance, insurance company A, and I won't say which one it is because there is an insurance company that does this, is very difficult to work with from a provider point of view. They give you a prior auth and then deny it. They don't pay when they should. They delay payments for, you know, 6 months. Just very, very difficult to work with time after time after time. You can go to the exchange and say, hey, this is what's going on. They could say, okay, you've met all the requirements, but you're still a bad actor. You're out of here. This is why. That wouldn't be a problem for you. They'd be clear and straightforward of why it happened.
Correct.
Well, in order to be fair, you have standards. Mm-hmm. If those standards are not met, typically you have a default notice and a remedy time period. I mean, that's typical in contracting. And if we're going to get that specific, then we need to have that kind of language so that you have a potential remedy to an otherwise, good company that needs to get a little reminder to bring back into the fold, or they are.
Mr. Chair, I think if this section is meant to create an agreement or a contract for the carriers who are eligible to participate in the exchange to sign and say, we're going to live by these rules to continue to be a player in the exchange, then we support that. But what we have concerns over is the ability or the new authorization that the exchange would have to say, we change our mind. We don't like you. You can't play today. That's my issue.
Capricious and arbitrary.
Correct.
Yeah. I think we're looking, I think everybody's talking the same thing, and it's a matter of having the phraseology right to make sure that what is intended is what is. So, Brian, fix it.
Absolutely. We also got on the record now what we're talking about.
Okay. Mr. Fiskum, Mr. Chair, you have not had a chance to...
Dave Fiskum, here for Providence Health System. Just two quick comments before that precede what I'm going to say for the record. First, I'd like very much, Mr. Chair, your comment about pre-qualification in the ODOT regime, which I think is a helpful way to describe this. I've not discussed that with my client yet. They may be listening as I'm speaking, you're speaking, but that's a helpful way, I think, to distinguish the avoidance of being arbitrary and capricious. And in the ODOT regime, I know you're more familiar with that than I am. That is a good approach, and I appreciate your comment there. I would refer you to the AHIP letter, which was submitted to Brian on the 25th, which I think goes into some additional explanation. For Providence, my two comments are quick. The first one is thank you for all your work. We think this is very close. Thank you for Brian to being available on a Friday when he was not in district. He was here working, and we appreciate that. Two things. We have concerns about the status of the assessment, which is imposed in Section 17. Our view is that the specific amount of the assessment should await the development of the exchange business plan. We do appreciate that Section 27 delays the operation.
Wait, just a little bit more specific.
I will. We appreciate, first of all, the assessment is imposed in Section 17. Okay. The question that I don't know from a statutory construction standpoint is whether Section 17 is, in fact, also held in abeyance by Section 27, which appears to apply to Section 11, the operation of the exchange, rather than to the assessment. Now, if Ms. Freeman was here, she may say that if you're delaying the operation of the assessment until you have the business plan approved by the legislature, there'd be nobody to assess. And so we just have suggested in our letter to you, Mr. Chair, that Section 17, the assessment, should also be held expressly in abeyance, just like other sections are, through the new Section 27 that was referred to earlier. That may be a statutory construction issue, I pointed out, because for us, the size of the assessment is really critical. We don't know enough to specify that, and we're awaiting, with all due respect to them, the business plan. That's the first comment. And that may be okay the way it is. It may need to be clarified, these amendments you're thinking of producing by Thursday. Second quick comment is Section 11 says any, and I won't read the language here, we just talked about that. We do have a concern that there be, quote, requirements, standards, and criteria for certification of qualified health plans will be left up to rulemaking by a new, as yet unknown, Health Insurance Exchange Board of Directors. And for what our view is worth, we'd be more comfortable if these qualifying standards were part of the business plan to be reviewed and approved by the legislature under a structure similar to Section 27, which I just described relative to the assessment. We're not arguing with rulemaking. We have confidence in the Oregon Health Authority and the exchange advisors you've had appear before you. We just think that those kinds of issues are important for your consideration as legislative policy matters as well.
That section, what did you say, 11?
11. Mm-hmm. The magnet section.
The phrase in our letter dated March 25th to your chair, Senator Morse, requirements, standards, and criteria for certification of qualified health plans, et cetera, that's left up to rulemaking. We're not arguing against rulemaking. We're saying that that issue may involve some policy matters for this legislature as well as the executive side.
Mr. Chair. Okay. Yes. So in simple terms, you want a buy-off by the legislature on the rulemaking as well as the rest of this?
Senator Bates, that would be acceptable to us. I just think that in general there are policy issues that are going to be inherent in that are worth your review. I suspect you'll be hearing progress reports anyway from all of the OHA staff along the way, so I don't know that that's not a major issue that stands in the way of your approval of Senate Bill 99 from our standpoint. It's just a point we wanted to make to you for the
chair. My follow-up. My memory of rulemaking is those rules probably won't be ready by February. I just don't think they'll get them done that fast. It takes, you have to post them, you got to have hearings, you got to walk them through, and most rulemaking, I think, takes probably a bit longer than that. So I'm a little concerned that in February we can't give it ups or downs because we haven't got the information we need.
I don't know how you could have rulemaking without a board.
So I don't know how you do that.
And this bill goes into effect July 1, essentially.
Fair points, Mr. Chair. Senator Bates, others, timing is a substantial issue here relative to the prospect of the federal law, and will that go into effect? What will the Supreme Court say? All of those issues. I think there are ways to provide for appropriate legislative review without necessarily either having that to be in February 2012. You obviously have annual sessions now. You'll be back in 2013. There's going to be time to review these things, including by legislative interim committees. We're not trying to put this up as a roadblock. We're just saying that the issues that are going to be embedded in rule that we'll be commenting on along the way may contain some important legislative policy issues for your consideration, however that occurs.
Mr. Chair, I'd suggest, because Senator Bates is right, rulemaking can be a long, laborious process, but I would also suggest that the board may have some potential rules when we come back in February that the simple and expedient way may be to put them in statute rather than do it in rule. I mean, it might be a shorter process.
Yeah, you have that opportunity.
So, I mean, mm-hmm. You know.
The other issue I'd point out, too, or the comment is, you know, will be pretty close scrutiny over the next 9 months or so until next February, or 12 months, I guess. A little less than that by the Legislative Assembly. I mean, we're going to watch this like a hawk. I don't think anyone's going to go home. Well, I hope that worked out. We're going to be really watching this carefully. And the loop back that you described, I think, gives us a lot of looking at this thing.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Comments.
Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Anyone else? Dan? Oh, John. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Dan Field, representing Kaiser Permanente today. Four quick points. We have given our comments to committee staff, and hopefully those will be taken into account tomorrow morning. Wanted to hit on just four quick points. On the very bottom of the first page of the bill, there's a reference to prepaid managed care organizations. Those are the Medicaid organizations that have to be brought into the statute in order to participate in the assessment, because they'll be caring for Medicaid people who are accessing Medicaid plans through the exchange. I've talked to OHA staff, and they've made it clear that this does not mean that the MCOs will be offering commercial health insurance, but I think there's some clarification that Rocky mentioned he'll bring back to the committee later this week to clarify that only licensed insurers with a certificate of authority will be the ones actually offering commercial health insurance plans through the exchange.
Are you concerned that this is a backdoor without meeting the qualifications?
I am. I think it's a huge consumer protection issue. Licensed insurers have to meet financial solvency and consumer protection regulations. They're licensed by the insurance division. I think the decision with the exchange legislation is to keep the insurance division regulatory framework in place and have that governing the licensed insurers. And unless DMAP, which regulates the MCOs, is going to change the way they do business with the MCOs. And by the way, Kaiser does have an MCO that contracts with DMAP, and we have obviously an insurance company. So we're in both those lines of business. The point is the insurance line of business is much more stringent in terms of financial solvency and consumer protection, and those are the folks that should be participating in offering commercial plans through the exchange. And it's the MCOs that will continue to serve the Medicaid population. And I don't think there's anything in here that intends to change that. I just think the construction of the language there at the bottom of page one is a little confusing.
Okay, thank you.
Second issue, page four, line 13, there's some references to groups choosing health individual or enrolling in plans, excuse me. It's my understanding that individuals will enroll in health plans, not groups. So groups will certainly participate through the exchange by directing their employees to the exchange and by paying part or all of the premium, but the group won't actually be making the health plan choice. That's left up to the individual enrollees, and I think that can be clarified a bit as well.
Where is that, Dan?
Page 4, line 13.
Oh, 14 and 15.
Mr. Chair, maybe I'm mistaken. Small group employers can apply the exchange either for the group or as or they can have their employees apply individually, is my understanding of it.
Well, I think that's open to discussion. My understanding is that a group doesn't enroll in a qualified health plan. The small employer brings their employees to the exchange and says, employees, I want you to enroll in the health plan of your choice through the exchange. Really, the primary value proposition, or one of the key value propositions of an insurance exchange, is giving individuals and small businesses a level of choice and selection that they don't have now. In a typical small business, even those up to 50, there's only one choice of health plans, and within that health plan, maybe only one choice of benefit design. So the whole idea of an exchange is different employees get to choose from among a wide range of health plans, and potentially a wide range of benefit packages in the different tiers.
How then would the tax credit for the employer come into play if you don't have a group enrollment?
Well, you would have a group engaging in the exchange to pay the premium for its members, but the group or the group administrator wouldn't be enrolling in individual health plans. That's left to the individual employees. So there will be some interaction between the group and the exchange administration for purposes of qualifying for the tax credit and hopefully some consolidated billing. So the employer is not receiving a separate bill for every individual. But the employer is also not saying, go to the exchange and here's the plan you choose because I've enrolled you in that plan. My understanding is that the benefit of the exchange is the employees get to go to the exchange using either a tax credit, an employer premium, or some combination thereof, and choose the benefit, the health plan and the benefit design of their choice. And if that's not the intent of the exchange, we're kind of where we are today, where the employer chooses the health plan, and that's what the employee gets.
We'll talk to Lori.
No, I thought it was sort of an either-or situation, but I'll check it out. Mm-hmm. Well, we expected most people to do it individually, but I'll check it out.
So, just the last issue I'll touch on in the interest of time is I think Rocky did a great job talking about risk mediation. The California Exchange actually adopted many of the provisions that Rocky mentioned. One of them in Senate Bill 91 that we particularly like is the idea that carriers can't go into one benefit tier, presumably the lowest benefit tier, and cherry pick by saying we're only going to offer bronze and we're going to have a benefit design, as Rocky said, that appeals to people, the young and healthy. So we would certainly support that. I think Rocky was headed in the right direction with that. I appreciate the committee's interest in that issue. It's an important one that gets kind of technical and most people lose track of. You know, one suggestion is in the risk mediation language on page 16, line 7, is you could just strengthen that a bit by saying the exchange shall adopt or shall establish risk mediation programs. It sounds like, based on Rocky's testimony, that's certainly going to be a primary function of the exchange board. But the legislature obviously has the authority to be even more directive about that.
Okay. Dan, sorry, could you say that suggestion again?
My suggestion is that on page 16, line 7, you change that from may establish risk mediation programs to shall.
Yeah. Agreed.
Okay. Is that it, Dan?
Thank you.
Okay. John.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. John Mullen from the Oregon Law Center. Our interests have to do with the people who are on Medicaid, low-income people, and there doesn't appear to me to be language here that speaks to Medicaid coordination. And further, the discussion about eligibility that begins on page, gathering of information that begins on page, I think it's 18, computer is dying here. Information required by the exchange. When I read through this, it looks as though the exchange is going to be gathering information, not only setting by rule what information is to be gathered, but also exchange with other entities for the purposes, I gather, of determining eligibility. Later on, it says on page 20, page 19, the purposes of carrying out exchange responsibilities, including but not limited to establishing and verifying eligibility for a state medical assistance program. I'm assuming that's Medicaid, Healthy Kids, other kinds of state programs that would be involved. In other words, one of the things that I'm trying to have a better understanding about is how this will work and how and if the eligibility process for the state is going to change dramatically and where that eligibility process is going to be housed. I think you could read into this and looking at that information that there's an intent to have eligibility processes operate out of the exchange, although I don't think that's what the intent is. It clearly talks about exchanging information back and forth across systems, but I think that that part of it is unclear to me.
Do you have that written?
No,
John?
I don't. I will write something up for Brian.
If you could do that, mm-hmm. That'd be great.
Okay.
John, I think my perception of this, and maybe I'm wrong, is that the exchange is not going to be able to do eligibility for the entire state. You've got SNAP, you've got all kinds of things we have to do eligibility for, and some of those things are different in different areas. But they have to get the information so that when a individual is moving from 200% to 199% of the federal poverty level and can choose to go on Medicaid, they can choose that. Many of them don't, but they could. Mm-hmm. So you have to have a mechanism for sharing that information, but I don't expect the exchange to be saying, oh, by the way, you can get food stamps, oh, by the way, you can get TANF, oh, by the way, you can do other things. It would be a huge burden. We've got people to do that already. And usually it's also a shared service between DHS and the authority already. That's one of those shared services we talk about.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, if I might, I believe that the department is moving ahead on some designs and plans for taking medical eligibility and isolating it for reasons that would work well with other programs and operating either with inside of the exchange or operating separately, but isolating medical eligibility because it becomes something that's different than SNAP and TANF benefits. It's really a different population in a number of ways, a higher percentage of the federal poverty level, for example. So basically, I'm just trying to think forward into the future, what the language says here and what's really envisioned about the eligibility process and Medicaid coordination.
My thoughts is going to be done by rule. I'm not sure we require any statutory change to do this. I think the department can probably do it. The health authority, I would think, have the power to do this, and it's a sort of an administrative issue more than anything else, the best and most efficient way of doing it. So unless we get a message otherwise, I think we're probably okay in that.
And just one very quick comment, Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, I certainly hope that's the case. And what we would want to avoid is having two different organizations gathering information and exchanging it back and forth. So something that's more seamless for the public would be good.
I agree.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other folks that would like to comment? Well, for me, I'm going on 8 hours sitting in this chair today.
Imagine how the chair feels.
Yeah. Well, thank you all for staying with us on this process. Did you have something?
No, well, I think some of us have heard from people who had major concerns about the bill still, and I'm surprised that none of them are here to testify at this point. It could be because of the lateness of the hour, but hopefully they will explain their concerns to us next year.
It goes to the full committee next. So.
Yeah, there's another shot at the full committee. But thank you all for staying with us. We will be bringing back a -4, and we will be adopting that amendment on Thursday at 5 o'clock. But we welcome further input, and we'll be working to try to make those accommodations. Thank you.
Get it home, Dan.
No, you can adjourn.
Get it home.
And with that, I believe, before we degenerate too far,